paradies. Van my grabba en my genies kan sy weg doen met die speech. Hy sy mama sieht dat met geen kangas in der rille. Ek schreef het die in Watson und met meiner porno-brille. Ay caramba, red is op ons uit met deine kanga.
My name is Tom Chick. You are listening to the Quarter to Three movie podcast, where this week we will be talking about Piranha 3D. I am joined, by the way, our discussion will be very spoiler-laden. If you have not seen Piranha 3D, you might want to see it first and then come listen to this podcast, because we're going to assume that the listeners have seen it, just so you know. I am joined by Christian Morosi. Christian Morosi.
I prefer to be referred to as DJ Chocolate Thunder.
It'll work. I also have with me Kelly Wand, who hopefully has for us a piranha-related tagline for this week's podcast. Kelly Wand, what do you have for us?
Silicone is a dish best served in fresh water.
Wow. I understand that. Yeah, that's a very...
Spoiler alert.
Speaking of spoiler alerts, Kelly Wand, Piranha 3D is a pretty plot-heavy narrative. A lot is going on. Can you give a synopsis to sort of break down for folks the events of the movie, in case anyone's unclear on what's actually going on in the movie?
Oh, you mean a piranha-nopsis 3D?
It's a piranopsis.
Piranopsis.
No, a piranhopsis.
Ah, yeah, what Dingus said. I like that one.
I hate this one.
Do you really? Come on, I would think.
I like it, but it's just endless. So
that's
I apologize.
Fine. I'm not going anywhere. I don't have
apologize
to.
Apologize for the length.
Another couple.
Unlike
hours.
Jerry O'Connell. spoiler.
Bring it on, right. Kelly Wand.
All right, here we go. So Richard Dreyfuss plays an old sea salt named Quint, who sets off an underwater earthquake with his beer bottle at a place called Mesolithic Dig Site. And it opens a ravine into this prehistoric cavern filled with piranha eggs, which have been living for 2 million years off whatever the aliens and alien were living off of just before the Nostromo showed up. And these ravenous fish eat Dreyfuss, but they still leave enough of them to wash up on shore so a cop can ask Sheriff Elizabeth Shue if she thought the teeth marks were caused by a propeller. So some dude named Jake wants to hook up with this cute brunette, even though Kelly Brook's throwing herself at him, because the brunette's a woman of substance who hangs out with dudes who can get her backstage passes to something. And because they throw water on his pixie shirt. So Jake wants to help Jerry O'Connell shoot an underwater porno, but he can't because he has to babysit. And also his mom's sheriff, and she'd rather he not work. So even though Jake's just a location scout, he does go on the shoot. And his brunette goes too because she's charmed that he's shooting a porno with Kelly Brook and a blonde chick for Jerry O'Connell. So Jerry O'Connell directs his actresses who can hold their breath underwater indefinitely by photographing them in this one shot through a pane of glass in the bottom of his boat. And he's like yelling stage directions at them that they can't hear. And then the two boring-ass blonde kids get stuck on an island because the boy kid got his knots mixed up, even though there's no ropes. So Shue catches a piranha after it eats a couple scuba scientists who make these sex jokes that everyone can hear over their walkie-talkies. And she puts it in a pail, and she takes it to Christopher Lloyd. So, I don't know the actor's name, by the way. He figures out what species the piranha are by dipping his fingers in the water so the piranha can snap at them. And then he goes, "It's not staring at me, it's sensing." Meanwhile, it's spring break. Eli Roth is judging a wet t-shirt contest, but then Shue and the cops show up and they shoot a gun and they say there's an emergency, which is everyone's cue to start the house music back up and jump into the water and flash their boobs and get eaten. But then Vic Rames heroically stands on a bunch of the piranha while he purees them with an outboard motor, but eventually the ones he's standing on catch on, and they open their mouths so they can eat his feet, and make him sink steadily down, inch by inch, like that subway volcano. So back on the boat, Jake's brunette makes him think she got eaten by somehow getting out of this inner tube without disturbing her drink or taking it with her or getting the inner tube wet. But then Jake sees his siblings are stuck on the island. So he asks O'Connell if they can go save their lives. And O'Connell, the ladies' man, strangles him and asks if this is a mutiny. But then Jake wins the argument by saying that he's just going wild. So they pick up the kids, and Jake warns them not to hit any rocks. So instead, O'Connell gets the propeller tied up in some seaweed, so they all start sinking. And then the piranhas start eating people, so Jake finally calls Mom on his cell and says, the good news is I'm with Zane and Shaniqua, and I'm employed, but the bad news is we're sinking, and some fish just ate my producer's dick. So she comes to save them, but Kelly Brook forgot what happened to the ship propeller and the dick, and doesn't pin her hair up, and she gets eaten, even though the blonde girl, the little kid right behind her, didn't pin hers up, but she doesn't get eaten, because she's a minor. So Jake makes a bomb out of a cell phone and a flare, and he uses O'Connell's body as bait, because he says it'll take a few minutes to eat Jerry O'Connell's already eaten body, even though with everybody else took, like, 5 seconds. And then he heroically blows up O'Connell's boat, and he saves the girl because the other boat's going faster than fish can swim and faster than explosions. But then Christopher Lloyd calls and says the fish don't have sex organs, which would make sense because they lay eggs. But then James Cameron's flying piranha eats that one guy. And I guess all of them, since they're out of flares and tasers and cell phones.
All right. Very good, Kellywan. That pretty much captures it.
Now I'm done talking.
So
forever.
So Dingus, you're the one amongst us who's least acquainted with this sort of genre. I think you would call it it's a horror film. You might call it a creature feature.
You mean the piranha?
It's part of a. I think Piranha 3D is part of a long tradition. And Kellywan, you and I kind of knew what we were getting into. I'm not sure Dingus did, and I'm curious to hear what he thought of Piranha 3D.
Mm-hmm.
How does something like this play for a nice young fella like Dingus
Peoria.
Mirlansky, I think. This is last name. Dingus, how does that play for you?
Retchingly?
Like you retched?
I did not realize I was going into a movie that I would think I was going to throw up during. I thought I was going to see sort of, and I don't remember either of the first two Piranha movies. The only thing I remember from either of them is some vague image from my youth, from some trailer or something, where some family's at some resort, and a dad is in a boat with his kids. Mm-hmm. And sticks his hand in the water, and he won't bring his hand back out of the water because he realized it's been skeletonized or something. And he won't take his hand out of the water because he's afraid to show his kids what his hand looks like. I don't even know if that's a real image, but it's something I remember.
It's just one kid, but I remember that too.
Well, that's all that I remember. And so what I went to this movie was expecting Jaws, and what I got was so incredibly disgusting. That I turned out really loving it, sorry to say, even though I kept wanting to throw up. Because what I just didn't know I was going to see Jaws directed by the guys who do Trauma. And what I, for a long time, I kept thinking, this isn't how I would direct it if I was thinking about Jaws. Sooner or later, I realized, no, this isn't Jaws. You're just stop being an idiot.
I think it's, did you bring your son and your wife?
Yeah, it was a family outing. We had seen the first movie we took my little boy, he's 5 and a half, to see was Toy Story 3, and I felt like this would be a good palate cleanser.
Yes, right.
Dude, people brought their baby and sat next to me, and the baby kept wandering around in front of the rails and bouncing up on the seat, and I finally got up and moved it and went, nice parenting, like super loud.
Nice. Well done, Kellywan.
I saw an infant.
I saw a midnight show, and a couple brought, like, a little 8-year-old girl. I could not freaking believe that.
Why do they do that?
People are idiots. Yeah.
I mean, that's the whole reason I look forward to R-rated movies, is I don't have to deal with babies. Like, other people's babies wandering around and gooing up my seat.
This was
PG-13. But getting back to Dingus expecting this to be like Jaws.
Well, I think it's not so much the rating as the 3D. Like, I'm wondering, do people think, oh, 3D, it's a family outing thing. We'll take the kids. Kids love wearing 3D glasses. I don't know what people were thinking.
Yeah. They think any 3D movie is a kid's movie. That's my theory now.
Yeah.
Because it's Toy Story. And they're idiots. Dude, hoteliers in Lake Havasu said an old person came up to him and went, I'm worried about your piranha. Are they gone yet? Like, that's actually happening. Like, they're worried. People think this awesome. Movie's real, Tom. I know you thought the Avatar Depression thing was a big hoax, but this one's true.
All right. Now, how did they do this weekend, by the way? Is anyone...
Lost Expendables, your least favorite movie.
Oh, man. Ouch. How much did it make?
I don't know. I don't follow that.
All right. Yeah, that's right. You don't like the business side.
Was the part where Dingus was going to throw up the part where Kelly Brook was nude? Because he's gay. That came out wrong. What were you going to say, Tom?
Have you guys seen Piranha? Let's talk a little bit about the history of Piranha, even though I'm not sure this movie fits in with that. I don't think this is canon, by the way.
No. They were military weapons in the first one. In this
exactly.
One,
the first Piranha, by the way, the Piranha series has a storied history. They're not just like schlock. Actually, they are kind of schlock, but they're schlock with an interesting pedigree. The first Piranha was directed by Joe Dante, and you can see touches of what he would go on to do with the Gremlins movies in the first Piranha. But more importantly, the first Piranha is written and features a great performance by John Sayles. And you can see glimpses of what he's kind of going for. And one of the things he's going for is this idea that the piranha were developed as a weapon to be introduced into the rivers in Vietnam during the war, is that this was going to be, the secret war plan, is introduce piranha into the rivers of Vietnam, win the war. Of course, the war ends, so the piranha gets shut on a little military base, and our protagonist, the hero and heroine, inadvertently, they're the ones who do it, let loose the piranha into the river. So in John Sayles' script, I don't think Joe Dante really appreciated what he had, the hero and heroine have to warn people. They show on a map how the piranha are going to be going down a river. However, they've lost their car. They have no way to get to population. So what they do is they get on a raft that the hero has built for his daughter because they were reading Huck Finn. So I think what the original piranha was supposed to be was this kind of picaresque journey down a river.
Survivalist.
At the sort of in the wake of the piranha.
Would John Sayles ever revisit that theme?
Yeah, with Mate One.
What's his river movie? Is it? I haven't seen
The Miners.
If that's the one you're talking about, Dingus.
I'm just talking about people on a raft.
What's the John Sayles one with people
Cedo
on
a raft? Coast?
Never mind. Go ahead.
But I don't know. I don't know what you got me. That's a good one. What? When did he revisit People on a Raft? I like that.
Isn't there something with that in Limbo?
They're not on a raft. They're it is people stranded, and it's not so much a journey as people stuck.
Right. Never mind.
So that's a goodish call. I wouldn't say good call. I'd say goodish call.
Goodish. I'll settle for goodish.
I call it implausible.
But so the episode Dingus remembers is you come upon a father and his son fishing, and the father has been, his hands have been devoured by the piranha. And that's one of the few effect shots in the movie, is the guy's hand eaten away. And the scientist who's been guarding the piranha, that's his moment of redemption, when he dives into the water to save the little boy who's stranded because his father was eaten. Now the first piranha, I don't think it's any good. And then the second piranha, directed by James Cameron, by the way, is flat out horrible. It's right up there with Avatar.
I've never seen it. I've always wanted to. And he doesn't like it.
The funny thing about the second piranha, there's no sign that it's James Cameron. It has this really sort of like oily European sheen over it, because it's an Italian production, and there's a lot of like bad dubbing, and it's just terrible. There's nothing.
Don't they fly? Isn't it flying?
And, yeah, exactly. And that's the twist, is that the piranha now can fly in Piranha 2. But there's a scene in Piranha 2 where there's a scientist character, and she talks about the events of the first movie. So those two are canon. However, what Alexander Aja did with Piranha 3D, using a script, by the way, from the guys that wrote Sorority Row, which I haven't seen, is these piranha are prehistoric creatures. They're not, he's not playing with this idea that it's a weapon created by the U.S. government. So that is the history of the piranha movies up to Piranha 3D. Now, let's... So, Dingus, you like... Well, go ahead, Kellywan.
I was going to say, I don't know why you like Alexander Aja so much, or Aja so much. Like, I like this movie, but I don't think he does action very well, and I'm surprised that you, like, he was the main thing to you about this movie instead of Kelly Brook nude, which to me, and did I oversell her by a molecule?
No, not at all. Watching the movie, I was like, okay, I understand why Kelly Brook was enthusiastic
See?
About this.
If you are a Kelly Brook fan, basically, if you have a dick and a pulse, which is more than Jerry O'Connell has at this point, run, don't walk to Piranha 3D.
Well, okay. So I'm not sure how much this is missing, I think, some very important things that I think Alexander Aja does very well. To explain why that's a huge selling point for me, I have to ask if you've seen High Tension and
No.
Hills Have Eyes remake.
Yes.
Okay. One of the things that I'm really disappointed in this movie, and like Dingus, I like this. It's kind of a throwaway trifle mm-hmm. on a 3D. There's some stuff I want to talk about in it that I adore, that I think Alexander Aja did an incredible job with. We'll talk about that in a minute. But I think where he really let us down is with what he did so well in the Hills Have Eyes remake, and that's introducing characters that you care about.
Mm-hmm.
There's none of that here. All this stuff about those annoying kids stranded on the island,
mm-hmm.
Jake and his girlfriend, and Elizabeth Shue as the sheriff, and Bing Rhames as the tough deputy, all of that just, there was nothing there. I was so disappointed that he couldn't bring this caring about his characters that made Hills Have Eyes so good. He couldn't bring that to this movie.
Yeah. But I don't think he did that in Hills Have Eyes as much as you did. But I should see High Tension.
Well, what he did in Hills Have Eyes is, even if you didn't care about the characters, they were good actors. They were given good interactions with each other. And very grim things happened to principal characters. This, certain characters were safe, and you knew they would be, at least until the movie's over. And because the whole movie's played, you know, it plays like a joke at the end, whatever. But Hills Have Eyes really took time to flesh out its characters and to make them real people so that when they get, you know, burned and beaten and molested, you know, it's shocking. And nobody dying in Piranha, what was really shocking to me. All the people
yeah.
you expect to die, die. All the people you don't expect to die, don't die.
It's not just a shocking thing, though. It's that when people die in Hills Have Eyes or Hills Don't Have Eyes, you feel you care about it.
Yeah.
And in this film, you don't. And I don't think you're designed to.
Right.
That makes those two very different things. But I see what the distinction that you're drawing. Like, for instance, these kids, and I sort of wondered as I was watching this, when the little girl is walking into the water.
Mm.
Normally when kids are used sort of in this sort of false kids in danger moment, I get pretty pissed off. And I wondered why does it matter? And this is still when I was thinking about Jaws. Why does it matter to me? Why would I get more annoyed with this than I would with Steven Spielberg using kids on rafts in Jaws? And it's just that I never really thought these kids were in danger, and I didn't care about either one of them.
Yeah.
I care about kids in general, obviously, but I just didn't think they were real people, and I didn't really care. And if he was going to kill them off, I would just say, you're a jerk. You killed that kid. But I never really felt for them. And with the Hills Have Eyes movie, I did.
Yeah.
Yeah, they kill off a pregnant woman in Hills Have Eyes. And that kid on a raft dies in Jaws. And you're like, whoa,
yeah.
Nobody's safe. He'll kill off kids, so that makes the movie scarier.
But that isn't this kind of movie, and I just...
And why, but it's like you said, like, having kids in jeopardy is cheap because you know nothing's going to happen to them.
But I think I think that's what he's doing. I think he's kind of goofing on that.
I'd rather he goofed on it by killing them.
I'm with you, Kellywan. There's a horrible series of movies called I think Feast. It's the guy that came out of that Project Greenlight. He did three Feast movies. They're all terrible. And to their credit, though, they're okay with killing kids. I mean, I think it's a pretty subversive thing to kill a kid in a movie. I remember when Guillermo del Toro did it in that what was that Roaches in the Subway thing? For Pete's
sake.
Mimic. Yeah. I think when you kill a kid in a movie, you're showing you mean business and that you're not mm-hmm. going to honor the normal rules. And Piranha 3D never intended, and I don't even think pretended at, breaking the usual rules. I say I was disappointed in it, but I don't think that's really what it was getting at. I think for the most part, this was supposed to be a very tongue-in-cheek, jocular creature feature.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And it is. Yeah. It is.
It never means business in that way. It never means business like that.
Right.
That extent, I was disappointed because I was hoping for brilliance or something.
Right.
Like Dingus, I guess.
What then did work about it for you, Kelly Wand?
Well, I wanted to gripe a little more, and then I'll say what worked.
Okay.
About it.
Okay.
Kelly Brook's last scene, very not iconic enough, considering how long she's made it through the movie. Very disappointed in that. I've seen her new.
I don't know what it takes to be iconic, but certainly, like, getting gross fish in your hair and being pulled down by your hair, I thought...
Yeah, but you don't see it underwater. There's no shot of her underwater getting gnawed up.
All right. There were a few good underwater shots, I thought, and yet they did kind of shortchange us there. They didn't give us that with her. Yeah.
I liked the actual piranha. I liked that they looked, like, goofy and rubbery, but CG... I don't know. I thought they looked kind of funny.
I thought they looked fantastic. Yeah, I mean, they looked fierce. They looked that little personality to them.
They had red eyes, like they're just evil little bastards. They look like the gremlins.
Do you remember the piranha from the first two movies?
Vaguely. I remember them just, like, swimming idly by a lot, and, like, you never saw them actually bite. Like, it was mostly in your imagination.
Well, no, what they would do, Kelly Wand, and it actually is a little – it was a little disturbing, at least as a kid watching it, is they would stick a piranha puppet. By the way, the piranhas were created in the original Piranha. This is another bit of trivia. Special effects guys in the original Piranha are fellows named Phil Tippett, who's known for this stop motion in Starship Troopers, RoboCop, the chessboard in Star Wars. And he does, there's a weird gremlin scene where when they go to the lab, it's never explained, there's a weird little stop-motion creature wandering around the lab, and you think something's going to come of it, and it doesn't. It seems like it's just there so that Phil Tippett had something to do.
Wait, in what movie? The first Piranha?
The first Piranha. It's really weird.
What? There's a stop-motion?
Yep.
Is it Dren?
It's not Dren. It's like what it is. It's the thing from a nod to that thing from that Ray Harryhausen sort of guild creature from.
What's it look like? You're making it sound awesome.
It is pretty cool. He's kind of cute. He's got fish eyes, but he looks like a bipedal underwater fish man.
It's Gollum.
It's kind of Gollum-esque, yeah. But it doesn't belong in the movie, which is really weird. Nothing is made of it. Nobody ever talks about it. Nobody ever acknowledges it. It's almost like they just shot footage and said to Phil Tippett, you know what, why don't you draw a little creature in some of these scenes? But then the actual piranha were done by a fellow named Rob Botten, who I think is most known, he works a lot too, for the effects in The Thing, the John Carpenter. And what Rob Botten did to do Piranha is they stuck, like, puppets on sticks. And they would, standing off, bang the sticks really fast, just jerking them back and forth into the actors, and have a tight shot of this piranha puppet head just banging back and forth into somebody. I was kind of disappointed it wasn't in this movie. They would do this weird, whirring underwater sound effect when the piranha attacked. Which is in both movies, and it's kind of, I would say it's iconic. The sound effects that the piranhas make in the first two
it's
movies.
It's kind of a bubbly noise, right?
It's like a bubbly, whirring noise, almost like some underwater machinery or something.
Is it them breathing or, like, plotting against us or what?
Who knows? It's almost like a drill or something weird. But you see piranha puppets, like, ramming into people's flesh, and then, you know, they're floating blood in the water. But they're all tight shots. So what I really liked in Piranha 3D was this idea of this school of fish just, like, whipping around people and chewing them up. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, there were some great underwater kills, and I was a little disappointed we didn't get to see I'm with you there, Kelly Wand. We didn't get to see something more dramatic with Kelly Brook.
Yeah. My other complaint is that the whole plot and shoe on the cable was a kind of derivative of Jaws 2. Like, there's a little too much derivative.
Oh, did they climb to Brody's boat on a rope?
He goes across the cable, and then he bangs on it with the oar. But it's like kids being dumb. It's the same plot as Jaws 2. Like,
yeah, whatever.
We know there's a one of the crocodile movies. I think it's Rogue.
Lake Placid?
No, no, no. There's Blackwater, Rogue, and Primeval. These are all crocodile movies from the last, I don't know, 8, 10 years, whatever. And one of them, the people are stuck on an island while the tide is rising for this river. Or it's not a tide, whatever you call it in a river. The river level, I don't know. And so they have to tie a rope to an area, and they have to all shimmy across the rope. And, of course, the crocodile can jump out of the water and eat them. So, yeah.
Right.
Also, the escape in Piranha 3D directly ripped off out of the escape from the original Piranha, where the hero has to swim underwater. And I forget exactly what it is. He's got to press a button or something. And it's with the piranha in the water. So he ties a rope to his waist, and he tells the heroine, count to 100, and then tie this rope to the boat, one into the boat, one into my waist. You count to 100, and then go. And then, he dives underwater, and he swims through while the piranha are biting him, and then he throws the switch, and she drives and yanks him away out of the school of piranha.
So does he count to 100? Does he kiss a girl for 100 seconds first and then tell the person to count to 100?
While the bomb ticks down. And Elizabeth Shue waits with her hand on the... Also, the fish coming out of the blonde girl's mouth, that was stolen from Dead Alive.
Yes, very much.
I knew you were going to say that. That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's an iconic image, too. That's like stealing Alien chestburster for me. Because I remember the Dead Alive, every kill in Dead Alive.
I don't think enough people have seen Dead Alive where it's necessarily cheap. I'm okay with that.
That's really? A weak defense. Well, come on. You should see it instead of...
No, I've seen it.
I don't know.
I just think...
No, no, I know. I'm saying as a defense, not enough people have seen Dead Alive, so they can steal from it.
Well, he's raising Dead Alive awareness levels. How's that?
Also, he telegraphed the last gotcha with his composition, I thought. Aja. That's another thing I don't like about him.
Is his composition?
Yeah, he ruined that last shot. Guys is like way too wide, and you go, oh, yeah, for
well, I got to tell you, I think that's a function of a completely other issue that I think is that he's doing purposely, and that I would love to talk about.
Let's get to it. Good. Right.
Yeah, go for it, Dingus.
Let's praise it.
I think that the completely other issue and the problem that you have with that last shot is completely related to the subject of 3D.
Maybe.
Now, I'm assuming both of you saw this in 3D.
I don't see any other
Kelly ones. Brook nude. That was all I needed. Oh, Kelly Brook 3D, Piranha. Great.
Yes, I went in 3D, yes.
Well, it's called Piranha 3D, and Tom and I talked about this beforehand, is that I was looking up movie times and trying to figure out when I could figure it out to see it, because I have to really plan hard because I have a 5-year-old. And what was awesome was to see there are movie times for something called Piranha 3D, which is the name of the film, and then Piranha 3D in 2D.
Yeah. Well, in the beginning, it just says Piranha, too, of the movie, doesn't it? That kind of threw me off. Because that's all it takes to throw me.
Wow, okay.
So now it's just called Piranha, because maybe if they were going to show it in 2D, calling it, like Dingus just said,
right,
calling it Piranha 3D, but never mind.
Well, I don't know. I don't know what it said on screen because my 3D glasses were effed up for the entire first part of the film, and this is why, as per my normal soapboxing, I will say, fuck Piranha, fuck 3D, fuck it. I just can't stand 3D. I can't stand it.
Kelly Brook.
And I had to go out of the theater during the opening scene, so I missed the whole sequence with Richard Dreyfuss. Get my glasses swapped out. Get the guy go up, and he had to like put it up to some electronic doodad, and then give me a new pair. And this is at one of the best theaters in the country. I missed the entire first sequence because my glasses were messed up.
Wait, you had to scan your glasses?
Well, no. What they had to do was he had to see what's wrong with them, because they have to be powered up. They're battery operated, and he was trying to figure out, well, wait, if there's a green light, and are you sure they're not dimming properly? And he handed me a new pair. It only took a couple of minutes, but I missed that whole first sequence. Okay, I just hate 3D. I'm going to keep denouncing it as long as we have to wear stupid glasses. As long as I have to wear glasses over my glasses, sunglasses over my glasses, I'm going to keep denouncing it.
Anyway, Dingus, what about How to Train Your Dragon? I thought you got brought around.
I loved How to Train Your Dragon. I absolutely love that film, and I think it's a proper use of 3D. But I still don't want to have to wear an extra pair of sunglasses over my glasses that I wear already.
Yours are battery-powered?
They're all powered. The glasses for this film, and for a lot of these films, have some sort of power mechanism involved. And in fact, as I was waiting for this guy to swap my glasses out, I saw a little handwritten piece of paper taped to a little part of his cart that said, battery problems and other. So they have to deal with a lot of these issues. And this is, again,
I think that's just some, that's only some theaters, by the way.
It has to be, because I have mine right now. There's no way that – there's no power source in this thing.
But your point is well taken. I mean, I'm with Dingus.
I agree with Dingus, yeah. But I'm also fascinated that he had electric 3D glasses.
Well, I've got a 3D gaming rig here, and it uses – you know, that's one way of doing 3D is having the glasses do some kind of render.
Mine just came out of a bag. They're like a novelty.
Right. That's one technique to do it. There are a few different techniques to do it. Dingus got saddled with some battery-operated shenanigans. Kelly Wand, you and I apparently went to some second-rate 3D screening.
Well, the joke's on him, isn't it? Because he had battery issues.
You missed the Matt Hooper.
Missed Hooper. Yeah. Ugh.
And that was Hooper, but I think I can get over that. But all of this is to say that as annoyed as I am with the 3D, I think what Aja or Aha, as Kelly calls him, I have no idea how you say his name.
I'm a racist, by the way.
I think he's totally riffing on and saying F you in some ways to the whole 3D thing. I think he messes with it. I think he plays with it. And I think that last shot that you're complaining about the composition of is a nod to that. Because I think this guy is smart enough. And for the whole film, I think, you know, that he's basically making a Girls Gone Wild horror film, and mm-hmm. that he's using 3D and screwing with it and saying, yeah, I have to do these certain things, but I'm going to mess around with it a little bit and give the producers in the studio what they want as far as, you know, throwing water at the guy's shirt and yeah. throwing the cup at you guys. But I got to the point later in the process where I felt like this director knows what he's doing. He knows he's making a 3D film, and he knows it's stupid, and he's effing with us.
He knows what to do with Kelly Brook. That's for damn sure.
Dingus, right? Give us examples of how you think he's sort of playing with the 3D. Because it didn't register much for me, aside from the fish chunks shooting up in the water when Ving Rhames was doing his, you know, last stand with the Evinrude for no discernible reason. I love that he's like 5 feet from shore and he's going down with the Evinrude. Yeah. I'm just like, dude, just walk back.
After shooting in the water, like water yeah. filled with living people getting chewed up, like at his, he's shotgunning it.
But that was about the only time where I was like, oh, okay, here's a fancy 3D thing. What Dingus were some instances where you thought he was playing with the 3D? So you mentioned, actually, now that you mention it, I do remember, you're right. The gratuitous throwing of the water on the pixie's shirt. Yeah.
The penis. Spoiler alert.
Mm-hmm. There's a point where, as a matter of fact, actually, I'm answering your question, Dingus. I'll field this. There's a point where
before you do that, I just want to say Last Stand with the Evinrude. Great title.
I think
I'm not sure who wrote that poem, but I love it.
I think it's Kipling.
It was Ionesco. Yeah.
There's a point where I think it's Kelly Brook is holding an oar down to Jerry O'Connell to help him get out of the water. And I'm like, oh, yeah, look, 3D.
You mean Kelly Brook or the oar?
No.
I like this movie, and I just want to talk about its good qualities.
So Dingus thought it was wretched and liked it. Kelly, you flat out liked it, you're saying.
Yeah. I was disappointed for the same reason you were. Like, I wanted it to be Dead Alive, sharp. Mm-hmm. Like, because Dead Alive sets up characters, too. Like,
sure. Oh, yeah. Dead Alive's got a protagonist you root for. Absolutely, yeah.
But I really liked the spring break scene.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a lot of amputee special effects. Like, they used amputee. Like, a lot of amputees got work on this movie, which makes it a community works project, doesn't it?
I wondered about that, because I know that he put out a call for amputees, but all this stuff you can do with CG, and it's already got a big CG budget, so I'm not sure what the point of that was, and I never really thought, oh, I'm looking at an amputee. I mean, these days, you look at, like, that whole shot, I don't think Jerry O'Connell had his lower half amputated for this movie, I'm pretty sure. I don't know. But you look at that, and that's CG. So why do you need
That wasn't CG. I think it was. I think his head, like his body, was under the boat, and then the rest was a puppet. I think there was more Phil Tippett going on than you give this movie credit for.
Well, there's a couple of things during the spring break, where, during the massacre scene, like a deputy being taken out of the, along the shoreline, where it's clear that you know that bone sticking out of his leg is a bone or some sort of mock up, and he's probably an amputee. So I see that.
I like the dumbass with the speedboat who was plowing his way through.
But I do want to answer your question, Tom, because I do have an answer for it.
Okay, yeah. So what were examples of him playing with 3D in a smart way? Because I agree with you that he's smart, so I want to hear about this.
All right. For me, it starts, the very start of it, after that silly water toss, which pissed me off, and I thought, oh, am I going to be in a movie full of this? The very first moment where for me, it's like, oh, you know what this is about, is when Kelly Brook goes up to the sister. And what does she say to the sister?
The little girl, you mean?
Yeah.
Oh, about her breasts?
Everyone likes.
What does Kelly Brook say to her?
The sister says, nice boobs.
Right. And what is that a response to?
Nice trombone.
Nice horn. And when you see a little girl sitting there with a gigantic trombone, and if you think about how a trombone works, all you can think about in 3D is, when is she going to use that freaking trombone? And a trombone is a perfect 3D instrument, if you think about sort of maximizing 3D. As soon as I saw this little girl sitting with a huge trombone across her lap, all I can think of is that thing sliding back and forth into the camera. And even when she gets on the aisle on Sand Island with her brother, she says, I wish I had my trombone. And they talk about being in a rock band, and I think, is the trombone going to show back up? I hope not. But just the image of nice horn, nice boobs. And that is, to me, the first clue.
Sure.
She's got a huge trombone. She's a little girl, and this is an image that really works for me.
Sitting with Kelly Brook gives me a huge trombone.
Yeah, I bet it does, Mr. Horn. The other two moments where this really worked for me is there's a silly moment where they throw the anchor in, and all I thought was, that anchor just smacked me on the forehead. There's a 3D moment with the anchor, and then there's the moment where Kelly, not you, Kelly, do you like champagne? Where Kelly throws up over the side of the
boat. Yeah, right.
The blobs of throw up falling on our faces. And those moments, those types of moments, in addition to the aforementioned penis, made me realize that this director knows what usually gets expected is that arrows get jabbed in our faces, that we get scares that are things stuck over us. In addition to the way swimmers would seem to hang over us in that ridiculous water naked lesbian ballet. And as the awesome seismologist divers are going into the cave hanging over us, it all seemed very obvious and out of place. And I thought very purposeful. Mm-hmm.
That's a good – I like Dingus's case. He won me over with the vomit and the penis, as always.
So what you're saying, Dingus, is more 3D.
Yeah. Dingus is a 3D apologist.
like Shadowcat, I am really into 3D. No, but I like the feeling that I went into this at the moment where the cup gets thrown, I was already set up to be annoyed, and I was thinking I was going to be annoyed throughout. And then I got to the point where I felt like, you're – poking fun at us for 3D, aren't you?
Mm-hmm.
And that made me happy because there are other 3Ds coming up, and I don't want to see any of them. I don't want to have to wear those glasses again. It pisses me off. I don't want to wear sunglasses when I'm going to movies. I've said this time and again, and it doesn't make any sense. I don't think it helps any, and I don't think the trade-off is worth it. I think there's one shot in this film, one shot where I thought, wow, the 3D looks good here.
And
only
it was the
one.
Fish chunks?
No. It was actually one random shot where the awesome and I love him, Adam Scott, gets into the boat with Elizabeth Shue, who I also love, and they decide to go off to rescue the kids. And they're driving off in this boat away from the carnage, and there's a shot of the Arizona mountains in the background, and they're on the lake, and it looks gorgeous. It's a gorgeous 3D layered shot. But everything else, like what Kelly Wand was talking about, that shot with him at the end where it looks too wide. He looks like a diorama dude. He looks like a figure who's been cut out and pasted on front of a diorama. And most of those shots in 3D look like that for me. And so I just don't need it.
Maybe it was the line of the delivery, not the composition. So maybe it's not aha.
I think he's doing it on purpose. I think he's doing that stuff on purpose.
I think you're right, except for that shot. Okay. I liked the cave a lot. I actually felt a little bit of mystery, like sense of mystery.
I loved, and I'm so glad again that I did not watch the trailer, because I loved the bit where he lights up the flare and you see all those fish looking at him, and that's in the trailer, much to my chagrin, because that's a great like horror.
I didn't see the trailer. Actually, I did see a trailer where it looks there's like a fake shot in the trailer, like where Kelly Brook is like.
It's actually
a bunch of piranhas.
It's the other girl. She's in all the piranha wreck right up against her face.
Oh, that's not Brooke.
No. It's...
I love the cave. I'm glad you brought that up, Kelly. The moment where that seismologist diver dude gets into the cave and says it's endless, and there's that huge pullback shot of the cave, that really, I love that.
Have you guys seen the
cave? And you don't know what...
What'd you say?
Yeah, the keep. Is that Michael Mann? Who did the keep?
God, no.
There's a great shot in the keep where they break into the subterranean cave and then it pulls away. And anyway, it reminded me of a famous shot from the keep, which I guess you guys don't know, so never mind.
I don't like that movie.
I don't either, but that's still a famous shot.
It was Michael Mann. I'm an idiot.
Okay.
I just couldn't believe it when you said it, but you were right. It was his piranha, too.
So go ahead. The underwater cave, though, that I cut someone off.
Kelly brought up the cave and how I liked it, and I just jumped in because that was one thing that visually made me very excited.
Right.
Yeah, and you don't know what the things they're looking at are quite yet. And when they break one off, there's another, what Dan was talking about, where he's using the 3D and he's riffing on it. Like, he zooms in on the egg, and then there's a spooky sound that kind of made me jump a little. I feel embarrassed that I jumped during this movie.
I hate jump moments. I am such a I fall every time, and
it's a case. But yeah,
the hand at the beginning, you know, Richard Dreyfuss's gnawed hand jump, and I know they're coming, and they still get me, and I just want to ask directors to please stop it because I fall for that.
What?
Time. I didn't need a single one of the jump scares.
It's valid.
No,
the hand wasn't a jump moment. It was a slow hand. I guess
talking about at the beginning when Richard Dreyfuss's hand thrusts up out of the water as a jump moment.
You can't jump that slowly, like it's slow.
So did you guys know? So a couple of things. Alexander Aja has said that's supposed to be an old retired Matt Hooper. That's exactly what he was thinking that would cast.
So he's turned into Quint because he's all bitter and disillusioned?
No, he's retired. He's just out on Lake Havasu fishing, retired.
But why does he look like Quint? Like he's not acting.
That happens when people get old, Kelly Wand.
How do you do that legally? I mean, how do you use that name legally? Because one of the things I loved about Adam Scott in this is that he kind of looked – he had sort of a Matt Hooper look.
Ah, yes.
And then to find out there's a Matt Hooper and that Richard Dreyfuss is actually playing Matt Hooper, is that – how do you work that out legally? Does anybody know?
Is that his name in the credits?
No. Dingus is wrong. His first name's Matt, and that's the trick.
Yeah.
Even though they never say it.
But that's the whole point of casting him and having him sing the song, of course, from Jaws, which I'm
well, sure. Maybe it is.
Well, looking at IMDb, I thought,
yeah,
I, thought
right,
I read
right.
His name is Matt Hooper. Am I
read somewhere it wasn't. It does say that.
Well, it is Matt Hooper, and I don't think you can copyright. You can name somebody in a movie Matt Hooper. Like, I don't think there's any way to say.
Yeah.
I'm just assuming. So another thing that Alexander...
Matthew Boyd, according to Wikipedia, just saying.
Another thing he said is that when Jerry O'Connell dies, do you guys remember his dying words?
Wet t-shirt. Yeah.
Except it's wet t-shirt.
Even though he's not there.
If he says it twice. He says wet t-shirt. So in an interview I read with Alexander Aja, he said that was a reference to, and I never would have got this, a dying line in Macbeth. I was like, what? What on earth are you talking about? Exactly. So I went and looked it up, and before Lady Macbeth goes off stage and dies off stage, she says, oh, oh, oh. And that's one of those bits of Shakespeare where, you know, good Lord, what is an actress going to do with this? Who knows?
So wait, those two lines are totally unrelated.
Well, it's so just the idea of repeating something before going off to die. And
as opposed to Apocalypse Now. I mean,
don't look at me. I mean, Alexander Aja, he's the one that brought up Macbeth.
I think he's messing with us in that quote. And
could be.
Well, Apocalypse Now is a reference to that, too. The horror is a direct reference to horrible, horrible, most horrible.
What's that from?
I don't think that's right, Dingus. Really? That's Joseph, because that's directly from the Joseph Conrad novel.
Right, but I think that those are layered
okay,
in.
Okay, yep.
I'll... So anything repeated is from Macbeth. That's
right, exactly. So we have to figure out that, when he says they took my penis, they took my penis. What is that? What is that from?
That's verbatim from Apocalypse Now, or actually Heart of Darkness.
So I agree that Alexander Aja is far smarter than you would expect. I think he's far smarter than the guys who did the script for this, which, like I said, the Sorority Row dudes. And that's ultimately what I enjoyed most about the movie, is stuff like Dingus is talking about with the 3D. And where I think it works best is in that fantastic massacre sequence. I mean, that right there is the
reason
to see this movie. Iconic. And here's the deal. Piranha and Piranha 2 both attempted something like that. I mean, the culmination of these piranha movies, you know, a movie about a feeding frenzy with flesh-eating fish should be some massacre scene. You know, you kill one person at a time, and then there's a bunch of people in the water, and they all get eaten. So the first piranha tries to do this, and it pulls its punches. It tries to do this with a bunch of kids at a swimming competition in a summer camp. And a few of the kids get bitten, and you actually do see one kid's body under a sheet after he's been pulled out of the water. But there's none of this sense of like a feeding frenzy. You know, the kids just get freaked out, and some of them get bit, and they all escape. The second piranha, where the piranhas fly, do this with a bunch of like environmentally conscientious tourists walking out onto a beach to see some sort of a fish spawning thing, and all of the piranha fly out of the water and attack them. And both of the scenes are so stupid, you can tell what they're trying to get at. And I thought that Piranha 3D really nailed this idea of what happens if you've got 100 people in the water and a school of flesh-eating fish. I just love how finally, you know, 1978, Piranha 1 couldn't quite do it. In 81 or whenever Piranha 2 came out, it couldn't quite do it.
And it took 30 years.
Took 30 years and CG technology and Alexander Aja and the budget and the Sorority Row writers, for whatever reason that the elements finally came together, I thought it was a great payoff. You know, this is why you go to a Piranha movie. And I love that whole sequence for a number of reasons. But that's what I feel. All the stuff about Elizabeth Shue and her family, good Lord, that was so disappointing. But what made up for it was that great centerpiece with the wet t-shirt contest.
And that's one of the things I love about what he's doing, is that there's so much of that and so many boobies in this movie that is so unerotic. But
what?
And I think that he's really,
I'm with you, Kelly Wand.
What are you talking about? There's some great boobies in this movie.
There are some that are great, but then you get layers upon layers of boobs.
I think he's
doing that on purpose.
Yeah.
And then you have gore upon gore upon gore, which a lot of it isn't CG. A lot of it is practical effects, I think. And a lot of that sort of what reminded me of Trauma, of like guys trying to carry a girl out of the water and she gets separated from them, and just like torsos and half bodies and heads and skulls. I mean, just so much unbelievable over the top gore that after, you know, sort of feeling like I'm going to throw up, I started to finally go, okay, this is great.
See, Dingus, you make the Trauma comparison, and I think that I get what you're getting at, but I think that cheapens what Alexander Aja has done. Trauma stuff is pretty just flat out gross out shock stuff, and I don't generally see a lot of point to Trauma stuff. What I think Alexander Aja did here is wonderfully, don't want to say subversive, but here's the deal.
I agree with you. I think it is wonderfully subversive. You're right to use that word.
So let me go on a tangent real quick. Let me sort of explain why it worked for me, and partly why I love horror as a genre. The deal with horror is you have to ask, you know, what is it getting at? What's the point that's trying to be made here? You know, most interesting horror movies are full of and are all about the subtext. You know, you can have a monster eating people or a serial killer, you know, stabbing teenagers, and that's not really interesting. But you can also have a story about anxiety about pregnancy, or vulnerability when you're asleep, or puberty, or the inevitability of death, or a crisis of faith. All of those are the subject of very good horror movies. And they're interesting subjects for a horror movie to explore in the context of a monster or a demon or a serial killer stabbing people, whatever. So let's look at Piranha 3D and what I think this mostly silly movie about killer fish is getting at. And I think what it's getting at, because Alexander Aja, he understands horror, and he understands the sort of the dynamic between sexuality and gore. You know, High Tension is a movie about repressed sexuality turning to violence. Hills Have Eyes is this sort of jab at this America's family values shtick. At its basic level, Piranha is about a killer fish eating flesh. But at a subtext level, I think it's about contemporary pornography driving sexuality and portraying flesh as a commodity.
Mm. I absolutely agree.
I like it.
Right. We start off playing it for titillation and for laughs. You know, Jerry O'Connelly's a clown, and it's all these like spring break yucks and hotties and the arrogant alpha males, you know, throwing the drink at the little downtrodden lead character who's a dork. And all that's cool, and all that's kind of like funny, and there's a lot of like hot nudity and whatever. But then the whole thing suddenly turns into this unflinching, bloody feast. And I think the piranha in this are kind of a metaphor for sexuality. And if you think, too, how the piranha in this movie, he opted not to go for this idea that they're a weaponized military initiative. Instead, the piranha are a primeval force locked deep underneath in a subterranean lake set loose by a crack in the earth. And they spew out and madly devour flesh. And I think that is this metaphor for sexuality. This idea that there's this rapacious sexuality lurking underneath people, and pornography sort of lets it loose and treats flesh as a commodity. And that's what these piranha are. And all of that, I think, is a great payoff. You know, you see all that expressed in this bacchanale turned into a massacre scene.
That's awesome.
I would agree with that, but I would say that it's more modern sexuality as far as how we consume pornography and how we consume bodies.
Sure.
You know, the way pornography is so available to us now. And, you know, just the way that Jake, the boy, the completely disposable, unfortunately named Steve McQueen hero of this, is looking at porn on his computer and doing research, and his mom looks in and goes, "What are you doing?" And he turns off the monitor, and she looks in again. She never berates him for looking at that. She knows what he's looking at.
Exactly.
But it's just a normal part of their lives, just as this whole bacchanalian, as you say, thing is a normal part of their lives. And I would see the piranha more as us, as consumers of porn, than sexuality, but I love what you're going at.
Yeah.
I thought it's corporate America marketing porn.
Well, it really, I mean, I'm no porn connoisseur or anything, but I think a lot of it has to do with this whole, shut up, with this
the
whole,
Japanese are so far ahead of us, that's all I got
to
say.
A lot of it has to do with this whole Girls Gone Wild approach, which is obviously specifically being lampooned here. You know, porn traditionally are actors and actresses on a closed set, whatever, they shoot it, and dudes in trench coats buy it from dirty little shops. But Girls Gone Wild, sorry, Kelly Wand, nothing.
I like that.
No offense. But the Girls Gone Wild thing is this idea of changing the way women perceive sexuality and exploiting it for people to consume, and people on the internet to consume. And I think it also changes the way that young men learn about sexuality. I think it's very specific to contemporary pornography and the way that that's evolved over time.
Well, especially since you have a couple of, and I hate to admit this, a couple of porn stars in this movie, or contemporary porn stars being eaten by fish or being cut apart in this movie. What'd you say?
Who are you talking about?
Jerry O'Connell?
Jerry O'Connell.
Is he?
Also, I guess also the... never mind. I don't want to talk about this anymore. Can we stop?
Don't pretend you don't know who the porn stars are. No, I looked it up too. That blonde chick is definitely a porn star.
The girl who's the parasailing girl is clearly a porn star, although more in sort of amateur porn. And
is that true, Dinkins?
Yeah.
Oh wow. Okay.
And there's another I think the girl who is in that ridiculous sort of my body's been cut in half and I'm going to look at my body, it's been cut in half. She might be one too.
Right. The cable, when the cable cuts her in half.
The cable, thank you. But I think there's a number of that, and I think he's doing that on purpose.
Yes, absolutely.
And I think it's about our consumption of porn more than it is necessarily about sexuality. But that's sort of splitting hairs. I love your subterranean analysis of that.
Yeah.
Well, there's a long history of horror movies about sea creatures taking women. From classic stuff like Creature of the Black Lagoon to other Roger Corman schlock, like contemporary with the original Piranha, there's a movie called Humanoids from the Deep, which is just stupid people in monster outfits. But Corman shot it where they come out and they like rip women's clothes off and rape them. Even the opening scene from Jaws, talk about iconic, it has weird sexual undertones with the way the woman is killed.
Right.
I don't know much about, there's tentacle rape, but I think that's part of that whole thing.
Mm.
So there's something about, horrors from the sea swallowing up women, and I think part of what it's getting at is this metaphor for, rapacious sexuality lurking in men, I guess. And I just think that this is a really smart, clever riff on this in the context of modern pornography as this Girls Gone Wild stuff embodies it. I think it's, for instance, I think it's intentional that the young actress doesn't, she's going to give into it, but by vomiting, she kind of rejects it. And she lives. It's the people who buy into
virtuous vomiting.
Virtuous vomiting. And the thing is, she's weak. She gives in. She resents the fact that her boyfriend likes this stuff. It's worth pointing out that they're the two virtuous ones. They get saved. They live.
My mom, who got married yesterday, gave me a Girls Gone Wild DVD for Christmas one year.
Mm-hmm.
And I gave them all away because the girls were such hags.
All right. That's very virtuous of you, Kelly Wanda. The piranha would not eat you. But I think also, keep in mind, there's a scene in this movie, and again, I don't think it's an accident. I don't think it's any sort of a just gross-out effect, although it is that also. There's a scene in this movie where a woman is rendered faceless by another man. He literally rips her face off.
Right.
It's about dehumanizing women and treating them as a commodity. It's about women's flesh being consumed. So, there you go.
Did the two dick characters who hate the hero ever get eaten?
Well, one of them was
that's the guy driving the boat.
Yeah.
All right. All those dudes look alike. So, yeah. Okay. So the other guy lived. The one who was angrier.
I can't imagine any of them lived. By the way, so the ending, I hope this isn't... How do you guys feel about this idea of... I don't think it's necessarily being set up for a sequel. Like, apparently this isn't going to do well enough that it'll get a sequel. But how do you guys feel about these sort of gotcha endings? Does that bother you guys, or are you okay with it?
It's a case-by-case thing. But now they're expected, so they're kind of predictable. And that's why I think Dingus is giving Aja too much credit for the last shot. But I mean, execution's everything. No pun intended.
Did it work for you here?
Me?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
But it was a good twist. It was just inexpertly shown.
Well, it says to me just how little regard he has for the characters and for that sort of B-plot, it's just, let's go ahead and just, we're going to kill him at the end, whatever.
Well, then, so what was the point of their getting through all that? If they're just going to die off screen. They should just die on screen, then.
Yeah, well, they were the framework for this cool bit about, sexuality, for this wet T-shirt centerpiece. I mean...
That's disappointing, though.
Well, it's also disappointing when Adam Scott, who I love, and boy, I was really rooting for them to do something interesting with him, when he took up a jet ski and a shotgun, I was like, yeah, awesome. And nothing came of it.
Well, what the hell are you going to do with a shotgun?
I know.
What are you going to do with a taser? I mean, she tasers one fish.
Yeah.
And he's shooting a shotgun at a couple of fish.
I mean, like that.
that's sort of the point. He takes, he's like, I'm going to be the hero. I'm going to jump on a jet ski and save one, a couple, three people with a shotgun. Why? I mean, I think that that thing at the end is kind of the point. He's kind of, I mean, how is that any different than anything that, that what Michael Haneke is saying in Funny Games? He's kind of poking fun at us a little bit.
He also drives them like 5 feet through the water and goes, okay, run to the beach. And then he turns
right, and he throws them in a boat. He throws them off the jet ski in a boat.
Yeah. It should have shown them dying right after that. Like, he just did nothing. He just threw them back into the deep water. What was Tom going to say about Funny Games? Not an outrage?
That's kind of wrong. I should, probably shouldn't have said that. But just that, that I have no problem with that last shot, because I thought from the moment where there's that moment at the beginning where Elizabeth Shue and Ving Rhames have dragged the body out of the water, and her first thing that she says is, what do you think if I'm thinking about shutting down the lake already? Really? This is clearly at that moment he's saying to us, I'm goofing on Jaws.
Well, and even Ving Rhames' reply is so stilted and obvious. He says, this is a big financial weekend for us. That was the line, a big financial weekend? I'm like, oh, my God, that's so self-aware.
I don't remember that line. That's pretty good. I mean, it opens with Hooper, so he's right. Riffing on Jaws, and he's singing the song. Like, I was laughing with affection instantly.
Yeah.
And so, I don't know. I just wish it had been... I just kicked it up a notch. Like, there should have been three twists. You heard me.
Yeah, they should have had more Christopher Lloyd. That would have made it better.
They all turn out to be piranha. Did you guys like Shue?
I mean,
did
yeah.
Did you guys think of Don McKay at all when Shue was on screen?
I did, yeah. She's kind of cemented in my mind as the character of Don McKay now. Yeah.
It's a sequel.
I thought she looked great when she was climbing on that rope at the beginning. Again, when I really didn't get, because I was still annoyed about my glasses, didn't get where the film was going, and those guys are annoying her, and she's being all badass, like, you're going to be shitting lightning for a week. Mm-hmm. Why are you reacting like this? But I eventually got what she was going for, and I kind of became pleased that she was the one being a badass.
Yeah, I like her as a badass. And she looks so good. God, that chick is ageless.
Yeah,
she looks damn good. There's
how did
no
she do that?
That? Fiber?
She was distracting me from Kelly Brook.
Wow, Kelly Wand, that's quite an achievement.
Yeah, but she wasn't topless. Boo, Piranha 3D.
1, 2, 3, not only you and me, got 180 degrees and I'm caught in between. Counting 1, 2, 3, be the partner free, getting down with 3D.
Every time you said Boo, Piranha 3D, Kelly Wand. That was mean.
No, I didn't mean it. It was like a Back to the Future 2 reunion, too, with Christopher Lloyd and Shue in the same scene. What do you guys think of that?
Aha! Very good, Kelly Wand. Very good.
Hey. Points.
So I can talk more about Piranha 3D, but let's do it 3x3. You guys ready for one? Does that work?
We all liked it,
yeah.
Didn't we? Spoiler alert.
I want to tell you real quick about the ending of another movie. Kind of a spoiler. Okay. There's a pretty cool, serviceable horror movie called Infestation. Have you guys seen this? Why would you laugh at that? It's a perfectly viable horror movie name.
How do you know that's not one of my 3x3 picks?
I don't see movie titles that are nouns.
Infestation is about these killer bugs, and they have to fight the killer bugs, and at the end they have to blow up it's the hive where the killer bugs are, and I think they're alien bugs, and only two people live. And so at the end of the movie, the two people live, and they are out on the street like looking for more survivors, and one of them says to the other one, look, and he points off screen, and the other one looks off screen and says, holy shit, and then the movie blacks out and the credits roll.
They did that in Piranha.
I know.
You didn't see what they were looking at either. They didn't show the action of what they were saying.
Good Lord. That just made me think of the ending of Infestation.
Why didn't you plug Tentacles at all?
I don't remember the ending of Tentacles. Did it have an ambiguous ending?
The dolphin
went.
Another Jaws 2.
They were killer whales in Tentacles, weren't they? Not dolphins.
No, they weren't. Killer whales don't have tentacles. What the hell's wrong with
you? The killer whales fight the
marine biologist. Oh, yeah, you might be right.
You're no Matt Hooper, Kelly Wand.
You're waiting for one of the tentacles to fall over, and then it cuts.
Let's see. Who's in here? Oh, it's me. Okay, this week's 3x3. I want your three best movie outfits or costumes or, I don't know, changes of clothing, however you want to put it. So that's pretty...
Wait a minute. Changes of clothing is...
He
always changes it.
Outfits. Okay, three best outfits.
Or hairdos. How about that? Why don't you put that in?
Or pairs of glasses.
Does molten steel count as an outfit?
I think three best implants. How about that?
We just saw them. Spoiler alert.
Three? Yeah, okay. Things
because that one chick got cut in half. No. It's
things you never see in pairs.
There was a third one. The fish spit it out.
Okay.
That's horrible.
Kelly Wand, you are going to be introducing next week's 3x3. I'm hoping for something as good as Best Scenes with Lava. So you're
it's topical. Spoiler alert.
Good. So you're going to start. What is your number three best outfit?
I will do a line.
Awesome.
Somebody sit on a duck. What?
What's that thing with Gene Hackman and Richard Pryor, Gene Wilder and Richard Pryor getting on a train?
I thought of that. That's actually a good one. That's a good one. I'm going to change my number one to Silver Streak. Good work.
Did somebody sit on a duck? I don't know. Did George Clooney in The Good Soldier? The Good German?
You guys don't recognize that line, really. The form's going to be outraged that you don't. Iconic.
Is it Rodney Dangerfield?
Yay!
Oh, Caddyshack.
Yeah. Come on. That whole outfit.
That's a great outfit.
And I'm counting his golf bag, too, as his outfit.
Oh, those pants.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
It's like where the outfit tells you all you need to know about the character before they even say anything. And then,
Although, wait, what was the judge wearing? Was the judge? No, he's not the judge. This is a good one, Kelly.
The judge was the terrific slouch.
Can you, for those of us who don't remember Caddyshack very well, can you describe for us the outfit?
No.
It defies description you're saying.
I don't know enough about fabric to describe what it's made out of.
Is it gingham?
Yeah, it's gingham, and there's like a bowler and a derby and a cigar. He's wearing like a fishing hat with a bunch of Vietnam-esque buttons on it. Not buttons. What's the word? Dingus knows what I'm talking about. Dingus knows fabrics. It's calico. It's pastels.
All right.
I don't know, dude. Really, I didn't know there'd be math on this test.
All right, good. So, Rodney Dangerfield and Caddyshack. Dingus, what is your number three favorite outfit?
I hate following Kelly Wand.
The guy who doesn't know how to describe what he just nominated.
It doesn't matter what you know or not. You always win. Can we reshuffle this at the 1 year mark? All right, here's my quote from my number three. I'm an advertising man, not a red herring.
It's a movie with an advertising man.
What's the Paul Newman Coen Brothers movie?
Hudsucker Proxy.
Hudsucker Proxy.
Dingus did sound like he was trying to do not necessarily an accent, but it's some sort of an affectation, like some 30s movie.
He always leads off with Coens after whining about whatever I did.
Is that right? Hudsucker Proxy?
I'm just waiting for Kelly to Google it. No, it's not Hudsucker Proxy.
I'm trying to find the Rodney Dangerfield fabric names. So I feel embarrassed.
I was doing an affectation because I didn't want to try to do this guy's voice because I love his voice so much, but I can't do it. It's Cary Grant, and he says, I'm an advertising man, not a red herring.
So it's obviously that Mount Rushmore one that we just saw.
It is. It is Rushmore.
Oh, North by Northwest.
Cary Grant in North by Northwest. What does he wear? Describe it.
There's a part of me that longs for that time when men dressed in suits all the time. And so we were thinking about this category, I tried to restrict myself, not I tried to stay away from things that were outlandish, that people don't wear, that are awesome sort of weird science fiction costumes. And it's okay if you guys did that. I was just trying to restrict myself because I thought of a couple of sci-fi costumes that I really liked. But I started thinking about outfits that I like. And I just love the way Cary Grant wears clothes. And I love that time when dudes would just be in suits all the time, like at dinner. I don't want to wear a suit. I don't ever want to wear a suit. But I like the way I look in a suit. Even if I don't look very good, I like wearing – I like the idea of it. And I like the idea of guys who at a time would get up in the morning and put on a suit no matter what they were going to do. And he – and this is sort of a point of that movie, is how he looks in a suit and how the suit fits him. And that image of him in any picture you can look at from North by Northwest, of him running in the suit with a tie over his shoulder, it's just such a great image of a dude in a suit. And then afterward, the suit's all messed up and he has to get it cleaned. And I just love the way that guy wears clothes and how this movie comments on that. And I like suits. And this is the one I came up with of these three. The one I chose for suits, this is the one.
What fabric is the suit made of?
It's burlap.
Ask Wendy. It's an iconic suit movie because he gets crop dusted in the suit. He takes a nap on his desk. He gets scraped. I agree with you. I like your choice. It's like a powder blue thing, right? And it's also a mistaken identity thing, so the fact that he's wearing a suit is part of his – like you go, oh, it's the other guy they think he is must have a powder blue suit because he always wears this thing.
What's the name of the guy he's mistaken for? Isn't there some great name that they think
– Oh, John Burlap, Gingham.
No. Dingus, do you know? What do they think his name is?
Oh, crap. Now that you said that, I can't remember. When he's talking in – when they're in the office with James –
Mason.
Madison.
And James Mason.
Yeah. Kelly, one, Google this instead of Rodney Dangerfield fabric.
Wait, Eddie.
What is a great name.
It's not his character's name. It's who he's mistaken for.
George
Peppard.
It's not George Peppard. It's George. Oh, crap.
Lester Townsend.
Oh, is that right?
His name's Thornhill. Roger Thornhill.
Oh, yes. Thornhill.
Roger Thornhill.
Yeah. No, George Kaplan's who he's mistaken for.
George Very Kaplan. Good. George Kaplan, because it's like a famous name. Yes, exactly.
I'm not George Kaplan. That is great. That's
Dingus, cool. Do that line again?
I'm not going to do that.
Come on.
That's pretty good.
I'm not.
Dingus.
But I love that he winds up in the hotel room trying on the other dude's suit, and it's way too small for him.
Mm-hmm.
And his mom's there. Oh.
I guess Tom didn't see
Tom, do that again, Tom. Come on.
I'm not George Kaplan.
That's great.
Thank you.
If you're Edwin Fox from England.
What? The hell is happening to the podcast?
All right, I'm going to do my number three. I don't think you guys have seen my number three. And unfortunately, not unfortunately, it's an outrageous outfit. But there's an English director named Shane Meadows who did a movie called Dead Man's Shoes with Patty Considine, and that's kind of his start. And then he did a fantastic sort of it's like a white supremacy movie called This Is England. And his most recent movie is called Summer's Town, and it's unlike the other two. And it's kind of, I was going to compare it to Rushmore, but that's not really fair. It's about two young boys. They're probably about 12 years old, one of whom is a Polish immigrant, and the other of whom is a troubled kid from out of town, played by a fellow named with the unfortunate name of Thomas Turgus. And he's the main kid from This Is England. So he and this Polish immigrant kid form a friendship, and Thomas Turgus, he's come from out of town. He's in trouble. He can't go home for whatever reason. He's got a bag with his stuff in it, and it gets stolen early on. So he's only got one change of clothing that he's wearing. And the Polish immigrant agrees to put him up in his house, but hide him from his father. And at one point, his clothes, I think like a pen or something, breaks on his clothes, and he can't wear them anymore. So he doesn't have any clothes. So they have to steal some clothes. He comes up with this idea to go to a laundrette and steal a bag. He's going to wear the clothes out of the bag that they steal. And this movie is so endearing. I mean, I'm just so touched. Neither of the kids is that great of an actor, but they're so good with each other, and there seems to be a lot of improv. So they come away with this bag of clothing, which is obviously like some old couple's clothing, mainly full of the woman's outfits. And the best he can end up putting together, God, I just remember my stomach hurting. I was laughing so hard at this. is this like checkered golf pants that are way too big for him. And a blouse, it's like a big frilly, but it's probably actually a dress that he tucks into the pants, and he cinches it up with a belt. And he goes through like the middle third of the movie wearing this ridiculous outfit. And when the Polish immigrant's laughing at him, he says that he looks like I look like a female golfer, or I look like a lady golfer. And it's just so interesting, this little kid, it's the best they can cobble together from the stuff stolen from the laundrette. So it's Thomas Turgoose's outfit in the middle third of...
Wait, the kid says that line?
The kid says, yeah, I look like a lady golfer, like that when the Polish immigrant's laughing at him.
It's the only British kid could get away with that line.
Lady golfer?
Yeah.
Actually, I wrote it down because I looked at it. I look like a female golfer, is his line, because it's in the trailer, which I looked up. And the thing is, it's a black and white movie, but you know, you can totally tell from looking at it that the pants are checkered and the dress has got flowers or whatever all over it. You can just tell, even though it's black and white, how ugly the colors must be.
From the body length.
It's a new black and white movie?
Well, Shane Meadows very clearly, for a reason that's not clear until the end of the movie, but very intentionally shot it in black and white.
How exciting. Wow.
So if you like, it's very different from Dead Man's Shoes and This Is England, but if you like Shane Meadows movies, Summer's Town is a different one, but it's just so charming. And it's got his sort of, it's got a little touch of social realism in it. And
what year is it?
I don't know,
roughly.
3 years ago? I think it just came
out on DVD,
like within the last year.
Yeah. Huh. I know you don't see black and white movies that are from the era of black and white, so I assumed it was from the last 18 months.
No, it's definitely like an artistic choice is to shoot it in black and white. All right, so that's
because that makes the suit uglier.
It totally does, because you have to imagine how awful the colors are, and your imagination is far more powerful than whatever color it actually is.
There you go. So it's like Jaws versus Piranha 3D.
You could go with that, sure.
I won't.
All right, Kelly, what is your number two best outfit?
There's no dialogue in this movie. So I'm just going to say what movie it is. The Clint Eastwood getup in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. He's wearing, like, a poncho in the desert. That one's boring. All right, go dance.
That's boring. Kelly Wan, did you play Red Dead Redemption?
Yeah, it's good.
Because you can get that whole
that
part outfit. Like that.
Yeah.
It's one of the outfits that you get if you play the Mexico part. And even though you don't get – I don't think you get any sort of benefit from it like some of the other outfits – but when I was playing, I was like, you know what? Screw it. I'm going to wear this because it looks cool.
Right. That's what's great about it. It's like one of those examples where it's completely inappropriate, unless they do wear those in Spain or something. Is that where it was shot?
Italy.
They don't actually wear ponchos. No. I think he's Italian, but they shot it in Spain. But
right.
Maybe I'm crazy. But they don't wear ponchos in the desert, do they? Like, wasn't that a new thing? Was that his?
I'm just assuming that it was meticulously researched and very historical. I don't know. Come on, okay. Do you need a poncho? What if it starts to rain?
Well, it protects you from the sandstorms, because that sand gets everywhere. Just ask Kelly Brook. All right. I think it's his turn.
Outfit is, I would say, we toss this word around a lot. Talk about iconic. There you go.
Yeah. I think we've reached the jump the shark phase of iconic.
Should we put a moratorium on the word iconic?
Well, when we're picking
I think I did that the moment I mentioned the word during the Inception podcast.
Remember when Facile hadn't jumped the shark?
Let's pick a new one. We'll be on the lookout for a new one.
How about fun?
How about erotic?
How about Dingus's number two best movie outfit?
All right, I don't have a quote for this one either, but not
I guess it. Can
good.
I guess it?
Go ahead.
Is it Chris Tucker's outfit in Fifth Element?
No, but that's one of my runners up. Nice try.
Okay.
Are you looking at my notes? Why would you even guess that? That's rude.
You said you're not doing any goofy sci-fi stuff, so
maybe he doesn't think that's goofy. Dingus went thought Piranha was like Jaws before he saw it. Wait, I came out wrong.
All right, this is
respectful silence.
Yeah. This is actually just a piece of clothing, but it's, I like the whole outfit, but I'm really focusing on a piece of clothing here. And this is from a film called The Wrestler from 2008. And I just, as soon as, this is the first one I came up with when Tom mentioned this, and I didn't, you know, I just thought of the way his jacket looked to me, with this sort of ski downfield, cheap old jacket with rips in it. And the main image that keeps occurring to me, and I haven't seen the film since I first thought, I don't think, is the duct tape on it. And the way the jacket has been put back together with duct tape in various parts, like on his elbow, to keep the down from coming out and to keep it his winter coat. And I like the hoodie underneath, and I like his jeans and his boots and everything. But just that jacket, as we follow him in those opening scenes of The Wrestler, and you see this duct taped together jacket, it just says so much to me. And I just really like that old winter jacket.
That's great, Dingus. That's a good one. And by the way, you could do a whole 3x3 on stuff Mickey Rourke wears in movies.
Yeah.
In The Expendables, he's got some great, I wouldn't even know, he plays a tattoo artist dude, and he's decked out pretty oddly. Yeah, good one, Dingus.
Yeah, he has Russian whips in that other movie that came out in some.
That's right. It's Iron Man 2 costume. Yeah, that's right. Which one of us is going to blink first and do some superhero outfit? I'm waiting. I'm assuming it's going to be one of Kelly Wan's number ones.
In a sense.
All right. Well, my number two, this isn't really outrageous. This one's influenced by my youth. This is an outfit that, this movie influenced a lot of the aesthetic of my youth. It had to do with, like clothes I thought were cool, and even cars. As a matter of fact, I once got in trouble. I was staying with my father in New Mexico, and he had this old Ford Maverick, and I would drive it around out in the desert and get it all dusty and dirty and think it looked really cool. And I remember once, because of the Road Warrior, and I remember once my dad saying, what are you doing? Get out there and wash the car. And I'm like, no, it looks awesome. And he's like, no, it doesn't. And he made me go out and wash the car. I remember thinking, God, my dad's a jerk. Who doesn't think a dirty, beat-up car looks awesome? Because it was a beat-up Ford Maverick. So Mel Gibson's outfit in Road Warrior, I love the asymmetry of it. I mean, in one sense, it's just a cool, tight, black leather outfit. But that's not what makes it cool. What makes it cool is the asymmetry. There's no sleeve on his right arm, and he's got the leg brace on his left leg. You know, it's got gear attached to it, and it's got that awesome holster. And the holster doesn't have a pistol in it. It's got a sawed-off shotgun. And the cool thing, there are no bullets for it. It's just for show. the boots, he's got fingerless driving gloves on. It's got an open collar. And it's so, it's such this cool, Western, tasteful, understated outfit compared to what everybody else in the movie is wearing. You know, the rest of the movie is this gaudy 80s shtick. You know, there's this punk rock aesthetic in the way the bad guys dress, and the good guys are all in white like they're a member of some goofy cult or something. But the way that Max's outfit positions him in the world, I love that. So that's my number two, is Max's outfit in Road Warrior.
It's also an example of impractical wardrobe, because, like, he's wearing this leather in the hot-ass desert.
Say impractical, Kelly Wand, but it's defensive. You know, there's a reason that motorcyclists wear leather.
Right, that's exactly right.
When they get, like, scraped up, you know, if you lay a motorcycle down, you know, you want some kind of defenses. And he's used to, you know, like, driving fast and, you know, I assume he gets in fights and, so it's not... It may not be practical, but I think it's functional for a reason. It may not be comfortable, but I think it's practical and functional in that world.
See, I didn't even know that was a thing. I just thought they wore leather because it was cool.
Well, I haven't seen Road Warrior, but as soon as you say that, I can picture what he's wearing, and think of him on that asphalt road. And I don't know if anybody rides motorcycles in that, but the idea of skin and asphalt
Yep.
Yeah, that works for me.
And it, and the movie definitely is well aware of that. I mean, there is motorcycle, there's skin-meeting asphalt. I mean, that's a big part of that world. Is yeah.
Why don't motorcyclists wear plastic armor?
Actually, I think some – I wouldn't be surprised if there's certainly helmets, but I wouldn't be surprised if some like motorcycle jackets have some kind of Kevlar in them.
I know their 3D glasses are battery-powered.
All right, Kelly, what is your number one best movie outfit?
And then, hold on. Advanced.
Is it a superhero, yeah. Kelly Wand?
Oh, as opposed to Mad Max, you mean?
He's not a superhero. Not. How dare you?
Yeah, he is. He's wearing a costume.
You know what? No, he's not a superhero. Mad Max, Road Warrior.
He's an anti-hero.
Road Warrior almost made my best protagonist beat down list. He, for a superhero, he doesn't fare very well.
That's true. But a lot of superheroes don't. Look at, what's his face? Christian Bale. Batman. He gets shot and exiled.
That's fine.
He can. And Spider-Man's always getting his ass kicked until the plot calls for it.
So is Spider-Man pick your choice?
Movie. Yes, actually it is. And Superman. It's a tie. Anything red superhero, best outfit ever.
Anything red and tight. Okay.
Whoa. No. I'm bummed because I don't know what... all right.
You don't know what the cloth is again?
No. Because I don't even think, not even convinced it's cloth. I'm just going to say what movie it is, and then you tell me which character you think I'm talking about from the movie.
Okay.
Because my original thing was everyone from the movie, but then I went, no, it's this one person. Quest for Fire?
What? They're all, like, in furs. What are you talking about?
Who stands out in that movie to you? Like, who's the first character you think of?
Daryl Hannah.
No, what's wrong with you people?
Radon.
Raising a bomb.
Ringo Starr?
That's not.
Ringo Starr.
Oh, did you guys see the preview for the John Lennon biopic? Ugh. Anyway.
Yes, I did. I thought, really? A Beatles movie? Thanks, guys.
Biopics. Gotta go. All right. Was it in 3D? Never mind. I'm thinking of the old man in Quest for Fire who loses the fire twice because he wanders into the water or the wind. Do you remember that guy? I think he's almost nude, but he's all grubby and wearing, like, a couple fetishes. You don't even know what his position in the tribe is because he's such a dumbass. But he's old. But they keep giving him the fire, and he keeps extinguishing it with his dumbness. Like, he's the kind of the reason the whole movie happens, even though he doesn't go on the quest, even though it's his fault.
And why are you picking this dude's outfit?
Because it was the most wretched character I'd ever seen in a movie. And that's why that movie's good to me, is it just shows the wretchedness of living conditions in 80,000 years ago, as opposed to today's wretched conditions.
So when you say he's just got a couple of fetishes on, what do you mean?
This is the second time you've used it like that, and I never know what you're talking about.
It's describe like shamanistic teeth on his, you know, around his neck or
so a necklace.
Loincloth.
A necklace and a loincloth.
I mean, he's mostly nude, so I'm talking about a nude old man as my number one favorite outfit in a movie. An old, nude caveman. I can't find any pictures of this dude.
Yeah, don't search with
you
that.
You have to take my word for it.
Yeah. I want to see him.
He's barely in the movie, and
all right.
Hell with you guys. This is a great choice.
No, yeah. I think it's a great choice. It's just that I never know what you mean with the fetishes, and I just think that I never knew what that word meant because you used it with the winners.
They're shamanistic. What
okay,
did I say?
Cool.
Oh.
Yeah, what they're like Aboriginal totem kind of things. Or I know what you mean from playing.
They're like rabbits.
D&D or something. Yeah, yeah.
Look at Tom.
Doesn't a fetish give you +2 to your armor class, I think?
That's not in D&D, is it? It's in Talisman. Yeah, Tom's a Talisman apologist.
Peter Straub.
I just like authentic. It seems like every caveman movie, they always look kind of hot, like million BC and caveman and even Clan of the Cave Bear. Like her teeth were really good.
Oh my god! I was thinking of Clan of the Cave Bear. What's Kelly one? What Quest for Fire? Is that the Daryl Hannah one or is that Clan of the Cave?
No, Clan of the Cave Bear sucks.
So this
really
is
lame. It's got all the right? And it, quest. Yeah, and there's like no. Language. Like in Clan of the Caper, there's all these like Shakespearean subtitles. Like they talk about their
oh my god, really?
daughter.
They're sitting there going, ooh, ah, grr, grr, and then
yeah, and then there's a subtitle that goes, my father's upset that I can count to four.
Wow.
But in Quest for Fire, no one can say anything, and this old man just, like, squawks constantly. Like, you don't even know what he's thinking. He's
Which
just
one
insane.
Is the French director? Like, I think his name is Jean-Jacques Arnaud. Which one is that?
It's Jean-Claude Arnaud.
And that's Quest for Fire.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's about grunting cavemen, and it was the year the movie about grunting runners won Best Picture. But yeah, it's just a very organic. It just shows. There's, I don't know. Did you see his next movie? I think was The Bear, which was kind of weak. Do you remember that movie at all?
Vaguely.
I like The Bear.
I like The Bear, except for those sounds that he made. The Bear. He's all these little. The Bear Cubs making these little.
Oh yeah, yeah. I remember that movie.
That kind of ruined it.
There's a lot of
natural bear sounds.
There was a lot of space between those two movies. A lot of years.
Well, I don't know how well Quest for Fire did. I guess it did okay.
It is the bear has the Dudley Moore voiceover, right?
Stop it.
I hate you. Anyway, I guess you guys have no idea what I'm talking about. Because if I say old man from Quest for Fire and you think Daryl Hannah, I don't know how to proceed.
What we can do is do Google image searches for these and post them in the thread. I'm sure folks would like to see that.
Don't do fetish.
All right, I won't say fetish. I guess that's racist. But
you can say fetish all you want, just don't do an image search for it. That's all I'm saying.
Oh, no, I didn't care.
Well, if you do, make sure that safe search is on, and you should be okay.
True that.
Quest for Fire is based on a 1911 novel. Do you know, you guys know that?
Wow.
Excited.
Could they write back in 1911?
They could write that old man's dialogue. Spoiler alert.
Because what is your number one movie outfit? If you steal my things, you're fired.
Just now you're not afraid to follow Kelly Wand, are you?
Thank you for doing that. That was quite a gift you gave me. Thank you, Kelly Wand. Yes, Tom, I stole yours.
No.
All right, I'll give you guys a quote. How about that? What a jerk, yeah. Would you like a lift?
Oh, no, wait. You just made me now second guess my number one. I've got a new runner-up. Oh, I might even change my number one.
Tarzan and the Bowery Boys. Mr. Old Movies.
It's not Bottle Rocket, is it?
No.
Oh. It's Raising Kane.
No.
What a jerk, yeah, do you need a lift? I haven't seen it.
That's a good point.
The jerk.
It's not. But the way she says it is, what a jerk. Yeah.
Oh, the jerk.
No.
Casablanca?
No.
Zapped.
It's from a film called Annie Hall.
Oh, good Lord. What's your favorite outfit in Annie Hall's your number one favorite outfit?
Absolutely.
I feel better.
Is it one of Diane Keaton's hats?
It's her whole outfit in that scene after the tennis match. I love that outfit.
What is it? What is the outfit even?
She's wearing a tie, she's wearing a vest, she's got these slacks on, and she's got this great weird hat. And I love the way she looks in this scene and how wonderfully awkward she is with him. She's just full, and the scene itself is just, it's weird and awkward, but it's full of this weird, lovely, unbelievable sexual tension between this nebbish and this awkward woman. And you know, I hate to keep bagging on this movie because we've been doing it in the thread for a while and we did it last week, but it feels like what Scott Pilgrim was going for in some ways. This
Winstead.
It's just this wonderful sexual chemistry that shouldn't work but does. And I love what she's wearing as sort of in a way of informing that and informing who she is as a character. She's just got this, I just love that outfit. And I think of that You know, I just love the way she looks. She's got this weird hat on, this vest, this tie, these slacks. She looks great, and it's specifically in the scene after they've had the tennis match. And this is the first time they've really had a one-on-one interaction. And it's just so perfectly weird and offbeat. And I love women in hats anyway, especially women who know how to wear a hat. Not every woman can. Every woman, that's good. Not every woman can. And I would love to be the kind of guy who could wear a fedora, but I'm just not. So I'm kind of turned on by girls who know how to wear a hat. And Diane Keaton doesn't necessarily do it for me, but I really like her in this outfit. And I just think it's the perfect offbeat outfit.
Dingus, can you think of other examples in movies of women who can wear a hat, though? Because that's kind of rare. I mean, other than a period piece. Who can wear a hat?
I don't know. Other than
women hardly ever wear hats. Maybe that's what he's saying. It's a really it's an exotic thing because dudes are always wearing hats.
Carmen, I'm sure there's that's a good one. I'm sure there's lots of examples. I just love this whole outfit. Her outfit in the tennis center after they have played tennis is great.
Right.
La di da, Dingus.
La di da.
I'm trying to think of other hat girls.
Yeah, women wearing hats. That's a top.
Mary Pickford. That's how far back I'm thinking. So Dingus has tricked me into.
Yeah, without it being a period piece, I can't. Who can get away with wearing a hat other than like Dan?
The Blair Witch chick, Heather Donahue, wore a hat.
That's right, and that you know what? That's a good one.
That was an iconic hat image.
That we have a moratorium on that word. It was a fun hat.
There's a wretched
radio show host out in L.A. named Pat Morrison who wears hats. I can't stand that woman, but she's known for her hats. That's not movies, though, so it doesn't count.
Pat Morris? Who the hell's that?
She does a afternoon news show, and she interviews people, and she doesn't know how to use her cough button, and she has taken to recently to Googling stuff while she's on the radio, and you can hear her mouse click. The whole time it's like this.
So like me.
Exactly.
She's just male me.
She's like you, but she wears hats.
Faye Ray from King Kong had that cute.
It's a period.
Well, what else is there? Annie Hall's a period piece. It's 30 years ago.
Okay, who 30 years ago? What other women 30 years ago were wearing hats? I think Dingus has an excellent point. Nobody.
Natalie Portman and Phantom Menace wore a hat. That's like a Pope hat.
That's a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away.
Oh, right. That's true. You mean 1999?
That was more of a headdress or a fetish, I think.
Dingus is funny when you... See, that's that putting game I was talking about. Just comes out of nowhere like a piranha. Bites my dick off with his wit.
Oh, God.
That came out wrong,
so to speak.
Intestinal difficulties. Did Tom do his number one yet?
No, okay. So my number one, it's a completely unremarkable outfit. It's simply a blue sports coat and a tie. And the movie opens with the character wearing it, and you think nothing of it. But the outfit is part of character development. Because over the course of Punch Drunk Love, you find people asking him why he's wearing a suit. Right. And he doesn't have a reason for it. He just says, I don't know, I felt like changing something. The fact that Adam Sandler's character, you later find out, does not normally dress that way, tells you that for some reason, for whatever reason, he expected something to be different this day. And I love that detail of him. And I love how, you know, Adam Sandler does not really do characters. He does Adam Sandler. But the picture of him in that coat and wearing that tie, you know, as Barry Egan, that's such a crucial part of who that character is. And I love how it builds into us learning more things about him. So that's my number one that I was worried Dingus might steal.
I had no idea where you were going when you were worried I was going to scoop you, but that's a good one. I like that.
So
it was dangerous because he's suit-centric with Westlist, so... He had suits all over.
Yeah, exactly. Like, well,
Annie Hall had a suit on.
I don't know about the down jacket and the wrestler. That's not much of a suit. But otherwise, yes. So there you go.
I like it. Too bad I didn't see that movie.
Oh, good Lord. So I actually know a guy at Lucas films. Actually, is it ILM? Well, he does sound design at ILM, and he worked on Punch Drunk Love, and he said, and I take this with a grain of salt because I think it's like a game of telephone where I'm only hearing something passed down the line and I'm not sure I trust it, but he once told me that Paul Thomas Anderson wanted a sound effect in the very beginning of Punch Drunk Love that was basically aliens talking to Barry Egan. Now, I don't think that's exactly what he meant, but there's this idea that something in Punch Drunk Love gets his attention. There's some kind of otherworldly or outside things telling him to do things. And the suit is an example of it. For some reason, he decides to wear different clothes. But if you watch Punch Drunk Love, it opens with him on the phone talking to the airline representative about the pudding scam that he's doing. And he's talking to the person, and you hear a noise that sounds like someone plucking a high-tension wire. And he hears that, and he says, I have to get off the phone. And that's when he gets out, and he goes, and he sees the car wreck. A piano gets dropped off, and then there's a car wreck. And so there's this weird idea of outside influences affecting Barry Egan. And it all comes to a head when Emily Watson shows up, and he falls in love with her, and they have their romance. But that's just a weird little apocryphal thing that I was told by the guy who did the sound design on Punch Drunk Love.
Sounds like Macbeth. Isn't that aliens always from Macbeth? All back.
Is he wearing the suit throughout the film?
He changes, I'm sure. Well, I was going to assume that he changes like when they go on their date and when he walks to Nevada, but maybe he doesn't. That's a good question, Dingus.
Well, I don't know, because now I'm wondering if when he's at his sister's for dinner, isn't he wearing the suit? I can only see him in that suit. That's a great suit. Or like at the supermarket?
That's a very good question. I'm not sure. I would in my memory, no, he never changes clothes.
Yeah, I think you're right. But I can't remember.
Like Pee Wee Herman wears a suit. Isn't he wear a suit, though, in that movie? Because he's a salesman or something?
Well, that's what you think when you first meet him. But later, when Luis Guzman comes into work, he says, why are you dressed like that? You know? So no, he doesn't wear that normally.
No, he's working in this, like, industrial park.
Yeah. They're selling...
I thought he worked at a mattress store.
No, that's Philip Seymour Hoffman's character.
Oh.
That's where he ends up going at the end of the movie. But the only thing you really see him doing is he's showing some kind of gewgaws to some businessmen when he gets the phone call from his sister, from his sisters. When you have the line about, yes, I have seven. How many sisters do you have? I have seven sisters. You know, when you have that little exchange, that's where you really see him at work. It's like he's selling, like, doodads. What aren't they, like, bedposts filled with candy or something?
Confetti?
No, they're like toilet plungers.
Oh, toilet plungers. That's right, with a hand filled with something. Yeah, very.
Isn't that why he trashes a bathroom? It has something to do with his career.
That's something completely different.
Yeah. That's something else.
That's something else. Very good.
I think I've seen chunks of this movie.
So Dingus, you made me totally think of the great scene in Bottle Rocket where Owen Wilson is wearing the yellow jumpsuit and they make fun of him. And you know, the older brother comes up and makes fun of him and says, you look like a banana. And then he drives off and Owen Wilson is like, oh, man, I really feel like, you know, he really got to me there. And what is the line? He says something like, and Luke Wilson, trying to make him feel better, says, yeah, but did you see what he was wearing? And Owen Wilson goes, yeah, I know. Like, it was really awesome. Owen Wilson doesn't even realize he's trying to cheer him up. He thinks he's pointing out that the other guy had on awesome clothes. I just love that little exchange between the two of them.
Tom, you've got a good Luke Wilson voice.
What?
What a horrible Owen Wilson voice.
I just like the way you said, did you see what he was wearing? It was just like Luke.
Do you want to hear my Cary Grant again?
Yes.
Oh, God.
All right, runners up. What do you guys got?
I got a Pris and Blade Runner.
That's science fiction-y, but yeah.
And she's a superhero, I guess. Rita Hayworth and Gilda, which I know you didn't see.
Oh, yeah. Well, that famous shot of her tossing her hair up into the frame. Yeah.
Yeah. And black and white.
By the way, Kelly Wong reminds me of Roy Scheider popping up into the frame from the bottom when he first sees the shark in Jaws. There you go. How's that for a connection?
She's going to need a bigger glove. Anyway. The great Heath Ledger, of course, in The Dark Knight. Like a really dank, wretched
look. Yeah, that's a very good one.
That should have been my number one, instead of an old man who is nameless. And this was my suit one I almost went with, but Peter Sellers and being there, like the idea of this gardener wearing a suit with a bowler. That was a great, iconic outfit. And it's such a part of the whole thing, like the character and the message, as it were. I hate that word, but... All right, your runners up. Oh, and Lance Crowther and Pootie Tang. And Vivian Leigh in Gone with the Wind, because it's like the dresses reflect her moods, like a Peter Greenaway movie. Okay,
What are those dresses made of?
Dacron and unobtainium.
Very good. Dingus, what runners-up do you have for us?
Well, I like Kelly's mention of being there because of the hat and because of the whole idea of – I just get this image of, like, brushing the suit. But I think he was doing that for the guy, his master – not his master, but his boss. But the idea of him getting dressed in the bowler, I really like that because the other suit film I thought of was A Single Man, just because I liked the clothes in that movie.
The thing about being there is, like, he's a dumbass, but the suit makes everyone, like, it's a big part of the plot. Because if he wasn't wearing the suit, they'd probably go, get a load of crazy man over here. But the suit tricks everyone and gets him into the presidency.
Right.
It's like a lot of presidents we can think of.
Right. For a throwaway suit, I thought of Reservoir Dogs, Michael Madsen, just because I went as that for Halloween for about 15 years.
How do you go as Michael Madsen when they're all wearing the same thing?
Yeah. How do you know you were going to Steve Buscemi?
You wear a cowboy boot and you put a disposable razor in the cowboy boot and you pull it out whenever anybody asks.
Very good. Well played.
The sci-fi one besides Fifth Element one that Tom ruined is Sting's outfit in Dune.
Oh, good Lord.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
Might as well pick those body stockings from Tron.
And I also, for really crappy sci-fi outfits, I like the, there's a moment in Running Man, I think it's Jesse Ventura, has to put on this crappy plastic armor, and I like that outfit.
Okay. I don't remember him. Is he the freeze guy?
It might not have been Jesse Ventura, but it's whoever gets pressed into service in the reality show. Like, everybody's dying, and they say, you have to go in. And he puts on this awful armor. He's like, oh, this is crap.
Didn't Richard Dawson wear a suit in that?
Maybe.
When does Richard Dawson not wear a suit?
It's the most appropriate use of that you've ever done.
Kelly, what is our 3x3 for next week? What do you got?
Wait, Tom, do you not have any runners up?
Just Bottle Rocket, which I thought of.
Okay.
While we were talking, yeah.
While he was watching it during the podcast. Spoiler alert. Oh, I'm excited about this 3x3 because
good.
It ties in perfectly, and it's more for Dingus. Three movies that weren't in 3D that would have benefited from 3D. If any. You can just have three, I don't know, none, and then that's your 3x3, which would be historic and iconic if we did that.
So basically three
movies. Tom is dead silent. Either
no, see, I write these down.
Loads.
I write these down so I can introduce, but basically three movies that should be in 3D.
Yeah.
Is that fair?
Yeah, but they can't be in 3D to start with.
Right, right.
Mr.
Three non-3D movies that should be in 3D. Three 2D, here you go. Three 2D movies that should be in
3D. It should be in 3D, but three of them, not two of them. Keep writing.
Okay.
Tom, what do you think of that topic? You're being
is there anything you need to take off the table?
No.
All right.
Well, no science fiction movies, no comedies.
Okay. Nothing with
no movies with vomit. Never mind.
All right, good. So we'll do that next week. We will also be seeing Animal Kingdom. And I know everyone's going, what? What is that? We're kind of doing that as well. This is a bit of a gamble. It's an Australian movie. That's pretty much all that I know. And it's been recommended by
who?
By very reliable people.
Oh, people on the forum?
Top men. Top men. That's what I was going for. Good Lord. So join us for that and for our three 2D movies that should be in 3D. Good Lord, what are we going to do with that? Yeah. I am Tom Chick. I have been joined by Christian Mulally.
Megan Morosky.
Oh, so close. And also Kelly Wand.
Hasta piranha, don't get any on ya.
Im fetten Paradies haben mein Körper in Bikinis tanzen will zu Reckless Beats. Heiße Mamacitas mit Slingtangas in der Rille. Ich chill mit vielen Potzen und mit meiner Pornobrille. Ay caramba, dreh dich um und zeig mir deinen Tanga. Ficken wie im Pornofilm hardcore auf der Veranda. Lotten, kommt mit, wir machen einen Gruppenfick. Wollt ihr Porno-Party haben, dann seid ihr herzlich eingeladen. Hier wird im Team. Alle Mädels sind gemein. In Süd-Berlin.
Please help keep this podcast free. Ignore it.